This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. The close of 2018 marks the end of a two-year period when Republicans controlled both houses of Congress and the White House. 2019 will bring divided government with the Democrats in control of the People's House. We all got a peek at what that might look like last week when the president met with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi in the Oval Office. To talk about American politics at the end of 2018, we are joined by political junkie Ken Rudin and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. If you would like to join the discussion, please call 419-710-0 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Ken, Howard, welcome. And Ken, do you have a trivia question to challenge Howard and our listeners at the end of the year here?
Well, I certainly hope so. Okay, so we know that Heather Nauert, she's the former Fox and Friends host, who's been nominated by President Trump to be the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Obviously, you go from Fox and Friends to the U.N. I mean, that makes complete sense. But there's some talk that she may have a political future after she leaves the U.N. And so my question is, who was the first U.N. ambassador to run for office after leaving that post?
Okay, so this is not an Ohio. Well, it could be an Ohio-related question. Who knows? Could be. But who's the first former UN ambassador to run for public office? Right. Well, if you've got
after leaving that post, right?
If you think you know the answer to that, call 513-419-7100, and we'll see what we can line up here as we go along. So, Ken, let's get started today. Why do you think the president called the press into the Oval Office when he was going to meet with Senator Schumer and Speaker Pelosi? Do you think this was sort of an on-the-spot impulse, or did he have some calculated purpose in mind?
Well, interestingly enough, both Schumer and Pelosi were told that this would be a private negotiation. At the last second, it seemed like the president said, okay, let's bring the cameras in. And so it seems like a last-minute decision on the president's part. But at the same time, you know that, you know, if you're going to talk about shutting down the government and talking about illegal immigration and all those things, that does good things for the president's appeal to his base. And that's a very important now because there are a lot of other things closing in on the president, such as Robert Mueller's investigation and other things that are involving Michael Cohen and Paul Manafort and Michael Kelly. Michael Kelly. So basically, perhaps it was a last minute decision to divert attention from something or another. But it didn't seem to do the president much good because he said, look, I will take responsibility and the blame and the entire for shutting down the government. And of course, Republicans would love to call this the Schumer shutdown or the Pelosi shutdown, but it can't happen because now Trump is taking credit for it.
I think that's exactly right. I think it pretty much backfired on him. And I think that is what he was trying to do. And by saying those things to Chuck Schumer, making it very clear that no, don't worry about that. You know, this is on me.
And now that it is on him,
right?
Does he have any negotiating room? I mean, has he sort of locked himself into a pretty difficult corner?
I don't know where. I mean, you know, the Democrats talking about $1.6 billion at the most. He's talking about $5 billion for a wall. It's, you know, How do you bridge that gap? What does he have aside from that to offer them?
Plus the fact plus the fact that this is the last couple of weeks of United Republican rule. I mean, starting January 3rd, the Democrats take over control of the House. And so the Democrats will get tremendous leverage. So there's no reason for the Democrats to cave or bend, not that they would anyway, because if they did, there would be a revolt against Pelosi and Schumer, immediately. And the fact is, look, from the beginning of his candidacy, Trump has promised a wall, of course, for the longest time, Mexico was going to pay for it. And then suddenly when he realized that, of course, Mexico was not going to pay for it, and suddenly the Congress was in, you know, was needed to spend $5 billion, they said, wait a second, this is so ridiculous. Plus the fact that most people feel that this kind of wall would not work or be successful anyway. It seems like the president boxed himself into a corner. And while his senior advisor, Stephen Miller, over the weekend on the Sunday talk shows said, we will do anything we'll do anything we need to do to make that, get that wall built, shutting down the government if necessary, you know that Republicans in Congress are not very thrilled about that prospect.
Yeah, anything necessary, and that includes putting 500,000 people out of work during the holidays.
It's bad press.
It's real bad press.
I don't know how much impact that has on the average person.
Right.
Could I just add one thing to that? Remember in 2013, the Republicans shut down. It was Ted Cruz who shut down the government over Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, and the Republicans are going to take this terrible hit and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And the next year, in 2014, the Republicans picked up 63 seats in the House. So for all the talk about what terrible political price the Republicans may pay for this shutdown, previous shutdowns, well, then you could go back to 1995 when Newt Gingrich seemed to shut down the government over a peak about, not getting a preferred seating on Air Force One with President Clinton, and that helped Clinton get reelected in 1996. But
yeah.
I just don't know if in long term this is going to have much political impact, especially if it only lasts a couple of weeks.
Yeah, well, I see that too. But the only difference being is that this is the president of the United States who's in the box. It's not, a whole bunch of House members or senators.
And he's shutting down the government that they control.
The Republicans control it. Exactly.
There was something in that whole exchange that really caught my ear. And that was, he said that he's going to get this done, even if it takes, and he just said, we could use the military, and then just goes on. Howard, what did that phrase mean? I was really taken aback by that.
Dan, I don't know what that means. If he's talking about using the military has changed over the years. And those kind of functions, construction, engineering, bridge building, all of that kind of thing has been taken out of the regular Army. It's been taken out of the regular armed services. It's been given to the National Guard, and it's been given to the Army Reserves, which means if you want them to build your wall for you, you're going to have to take all of those people, nationalize federalize the National Guard, bring out all of these Army Reserve companies, and put them to work for months and months and months after they have spent the last several years on multiple deployments overseas. It's just going to cause nothing but havoc. But I don't know what he means.
Yeah.
He didn't explain what he means.
And it's not like the Army does that for free either, by the way.
No.
You still need money, right?
But the regular foot soldier, the guy, the infantryman, they don't do that. That's not the work that they do. That's done by National Guard companies. That's done by Army Reserve units.
I think you're spending too much time focusing on something that I have a feeling that Trump just threw in without even thinking.
Throwaway line,
because
sure.
The way he said it, he says, I don't know, nothing's going to stop me. Schumer, the military, whatever it is, it's going to be done. It just seems like he threw out that word without connection
to
anything.
Yeah.
That's it just hit me as like a word that it sounded important to him, so he mentioned it, but I really don't think he's given it that much that thought, at least in that context.
No, I agree. I don't think he's given it that much thought. It's apparent he has, because if he had given it much thought or he had talked to the military, they would have said, wait a minute, Mr. President, there's a problem here.
Well, I guess the only reason it catches my ear as a colonial revolutionary historian, you know, the role of the military in a republic is highly sensitive, and that's why I listened. Let me just go on, though. What's the implications for both Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer coming out of this meeting, Ken? I mean, they were the ones caught by surprise, but it looks to me like they came out, or at least Nancy Pelosi came out looking fairly good on this.
Well, I think they both did, and especially the fact when Trump alluded to the fact that alluded to his theory that Nancy Pelosi is having trouble with her own membership in the House, and she said, basically, how dare you, Mr. President, assume about my relationship with my colleagues because I come in with a very strong position. But having said that, like a day or two later, basically, the deal that she struck with her fellow House Democrats was that she would return as Speaker, but for a 4-year limit, and then she'd give way to new and younger leadership. You know, she's 78 years old. She's led the Democrats in the House for 15 years. Much of the opposition to her was not about ideology, but they just need call for new leadership. So it's interesting. I thought she played a very strong hand with the president. She didn't back down. Chuck Schumer didn't back down. But yet a day or two later, she Nancy Pelosi agreed to basically put term limits on her next tenure as House Speaker. I thought that was interesting.
Howard, any?
Yeah, I agree with that. If you just looked at them and their body language while Trump was, issuing all these statements about, I'm taking responsibility, this is on me, I'll do this, and Schumer just had this smile on his face and was kind of looking off into the distance. Pelosi was just kind of politely listening with a little grin on her face. I mean, they clearly came out of there on top.
Okay. Well,
Schumer definitely said, look, he said, look, we agree. We agree to disagree because why shut down the government over a disagreement?
Yeah.
Let's
mm-hmm.
have negotiations. Let's have some talks. But just shutting it down unilaterally to satisfy your base, which is what Schumer said, I thought he looked very, very impressive was Mike Pence. He sat there and didn't say a word throughout that whole thing. He was sitting there to the yeah. president's right. He just sat there without saying a word. It was pretty remarkable.
Awkward.
Awkward.
Ken, will you just repeat your trivia question before we go into the break?
Okay, so we may have a new U.S. ambassador to the U.N. My question is, who may have a political future after that? My question is, who was the first U.N. ambassador to run for office after leaving that post?
Okay, I just want to be clear. Our board is lit up with, and I don't think we can take any calls. People are really calling in on this. So this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. Michael Cohen and Paul Manafort convicted and facing substantial sentences. Michael Flynn and David Pecker are cooperating with prosecutors. Now investigators and prosecutors are digging into the campaign, the inaugural committee, the Trump real estate company, and the Trump Foundation for insight into how government will operate in this growingly complex legal and political environment. We are joined today by political junkie Ken Rudin and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. If you'd like to join the conversation after we answer the trivia question, you can call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. Ken, just so everybody remembers the question, just read it one more time, and then we have got lots of people who know the answer, they think.
Yeah.
Well, the question is, who was the first U.S. ambassador to the United Nations to run for office after leaving that post?
Okay. We're going to start with Don. Don, you have a good idea?
No, just a wild guess.
Okay.
But I'm going to go with Shirley Temple Black.
Shirley Temple Black. Ken, what about that?
Shirley Temple Black did run for office in 1967 for Congress in California. Actually, she was never U.S. ambassador to the U.N., although she served briefly in a U.N. position. But she ran for office before she served in the U.N.
Okay, so, but it's not the answer?
Correct, it's not the answer.
Not the answer.
This is before she came to the U.N.
Okay, so we have a number of other Shirley Temple Black, but we're going to go to Jason, who has a different answer. Jason, what's your guess?
It's a guess. Adlai Stevenson.
Adlai Stevenson. Ken?
Well, actually, Adlai Stevenson didn't do anything after leaving the U.N. because he died while he was still ambassador. He ran for president twice, actually three times, in 1952, 1956, again in 1960. He was also governor of Illinois, but when he was in July of 1965, while he was still U.S. ambassador to the U.N., he died, I believe, on a London street. He died in Europe, but yes, he was still in office at the U.N. when he died.
Okay. Chris, you have another suggestion here.
Yeah, my guess is George H.W. Bush.
Ah, somebody we've heard a lot about recently.
Well, George H.W. Bush did run for office after he served in the U.N., but he is not the first.
He is not the first, so you got part of it, okay. And Roger, how about you? You have another idea.
Yes, my guess was Henry Cabot Lodge.
Ken, what about that?
Henry Cabot Lodge was a U.S. ambassador to the U.N. under Eisenhower, and in 1960, Henry Cabot Lodge was on Richard Nixon's ticket for vice president, so Henry Cabot Lodge is the correct answer.
Congratulations.
Hey, very good.
Now we'll find out if Howard got it right.
No, Howard didn't. I was actually with Shirley Temple Black.
Uh-huh.
That was the first thing that came to my mind, but yeah, that's right. She did not. She wasn't the U.S. ambassador.
So,
and she didn't run for office afterward.
Yeah.
So, Roger, stay on the line. We'll pick that up. And, Ken, congratulations.
Yeah.
On those rare occasions that you've gotten Howard, he hasn't been able to figure it out. But we'll give him.
But you do know that after she left the UN, Shirley Temple Black worked for Frank Lausche.
Yeah.
So that was a surprise.
Okay. Well, I'm not going there.
Nobody,
yeah. All right. Now, I'm going to give Howard a really tough question just to start this segment off.
All right.
And that is, in a short two or three sentences, give me the job description for the new acting White House Chief of Staff, Mick Mulvaney.
Good luck, Howard.
Well, I suppose stand around and be yelled at quite a bit. And wait until the man fires you. That's pretty much all there is of these jobs. But he's been like everywhere. I mean, he's been in all kinds of situations. So he's like, he plugs into just whatever Trump seems to need at the moment. But why this is acting? Why not just say, okay, here, you know, you're it.
Yeah, Ken, do you
what's
have
he any, acting until?
Any insight into that? Why he's acting rather than just chief
well,
of staff?
The reason why that's a surprise is because the president's first choice was Nick Ayers, who's the chief of staff to Vice President Pence. And the reason he didn't pick Ayers, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why, but Ayers wanted to do it only temporarily. And the president said, well, I really want somebody full-time and not acting. Here we are picking after other people said no. Chris Christie was on the list, which I thought was very interesting, given the fact. I mean, could you imagine Chris Christie as White House Chief of Staff, the guy who put Jared Kushner's father in prison for tax evasion?
Oh my.
I mean, that's what Chris Christie did when as U.S. attorney. So that would have been very interesting. But you're absolutely right. Mulvaney is the guy who fills in whatever position the president wants. He's the budget director now. He was also the acting head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the one that
Rich Cordray.
Our friend from Ohio. Richard Cordray used to hold held. And right. And before that, Elizabeth Warren. So anyway, so Mulvaney seems to be the jack of all trades, but as according to Sarah Huckabee Sanders, he's not leaving the OMB, so he'll still be on that payroll. And it's just, I don't know, it just, look, the thing, the difference is that John Kelly, I mean, it's a thankless job being the chief of staff under a president who thinks he's his own chief of staff. But the fact is, John Kelly was picked to you know, figure out some kind of order in the White House, get rid of that infighting. He failed miserably. But Mulvaney doesn't have the reputation Kelly did. Kelly had good relationships with Democrats and Republicans. Mulvaney is a pretty ideological kind of guy, very conservative, believes completely in the Trump agenda. And that's fine, but given the fact that this is going to be a very tough year for the president with all these investigations going on, with the Democrats now in the control of the House, you wonder if a hard-edged guy like Mulvaney is the right guy. Yeah. But then in answer to what Howard said, whether any person could do this job in the Trump White House.
Yeah, see, Ken, that's my question is, I mean, do you see anybody out there who is a Kelly-like figure that could, you know, come in and have those kind of relations with the Democrats and also talk to the president frankly when he
no,
feels
but
he needs to.
Kelly couldn't do it either.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. Kelly, I mean, Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner like Kelly at all.
Right.
Kelly and the president had shouting matches, profane shouting matches at each other.
Yeah.
And he was supposed to be the adult in the room. So
it was
I don't know.
Like Nancy Reagan
Reagan.
Yeah, Donald Reagan.
Donald Reagan.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how that unfolds. But as I think what Ken was saying, that in a time when things are shifting and with Democrats actually having a voice in one of the houses of Congress, it is an awkward, it's a funny choice at this particular moment, I think. But, you know, we'll see how that plays out. Let's take a look at the issue of governing in the midst of all of these investigations. You know, sometimes we forget the government is there to govern and execute and make things happen. These investigations can have just gone in every direction. The Russian interference, campaign financing, Trump Organization business deals, Trump foundations. It's gone everywhere. How do you govern in the midst of that?
Well, good question. I mean, the Trump administration, Republicans have done some things done. They pushed through the $1.5 trillion cut. They did get two Supreme Court justices. They basically have remade the federal judiciary with a record number of judges appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. But as far as so many other things about environmental policy, foreign relations, it just seems to be going by the wayside. And so I don't know how much governing they could have they did in the 2 years when they had, you know, unified party rule of the government. Now with the Democrats, as you say, Dan, you know, now taking over the House with more investigations, more subpoena power, more testifying going on, and the fact that Trump seems to be besieged by all sides, not only by the Democrats, but by Robert Mueller and the other investigations going on, the campaign finance, the money that Michael Cohen funneled into, you know, Stormy Daniels and the Playboy Playmate to silence them. I don't know how much governing will be done anyway in a year before the presidential election starts, but especially in this year with a besieged person in the White House.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And you can tell by the fact that, you know, there's stories out there say that he doesn't show up in the Oval Office until noon, you know, noon. And, you know, there's questions about how engaged is he or can he be in governing when he is besieged like this with all of these investigations into every aspect of his life.
Well, we have a call.
Public and private.
Can I just say one thing before the caller? Just one thing. But yet his numbers, his President Trump's numbers, are not that much different than George W. Bush or Barack Obama's was after their first midterm elections. And both did poorly after their first. Bush lost, well, not after 2002, but after 2006. The Republicans lost both the House and Senate. In 2014, the Democrats got clobbered in the House. So basically, Trump's numbers are not too dissimilar from Bush's and Obama's. So yeah, it may not be that much different.
Okay. We do have a caller. Dick is on the line, and I think has a question that feeds into the topic I've tried to introduce. Dick, what is your question?
Yeah, thank you. My question is, if in fact the hush money payments had been made out of Trump's campaign funds money instead of outside slush funds, would that have been legal?
So it's a legal question here. Ken?
Well, that's an important question, because remember John Edwards, the senator from North Carolina, was also accused of using campaign money to silence the story about affair with this woman out of wedlock, if Elizabeth died answer. But the point is that even though Edwards was indicted and it went to trial, it was thrown out, or it was the jury ruled against convicting him. So I don't know. And that was with, I think either way, if you're using money to silence an opponent to help an election, that sounds like campaign finance violations, whether it's from the campaign monies or not. But I think with John Edwards, that was campaign money, and he was exonerated. So I'm not sure how much of a legal jeopardy Trump may be for this. I don't know the law that well.
I think he could go into court and make a case that yes, we did this out of campaign funds to further his chances of winning election. And, you know, clearly that's what it was about. It was furthering his chances of election, because this would have looked pretty bad.
The timing of this.
The timing of it, right.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think Ken's raising is technical parts of the law, which is what Dick raised. And I think that's important to keep in mind, that these are not clear. These are complicated issues.
They are complicated issues. But, you know, we've also got Supreme Court decisions, about campaign money, which pretty much says anything goes. You can spend money to lie about your opponents. You know, if you can do that, can you use the campaign money to pay off somebody that you had an affair with?
I think the answer is, it sounds awful. It may not pass the smell test, but is it grounds for impeachment? Is it? I just don't know.
Yeah,
I don't think anybody has a real clear sense of what it really means. I mean, they keep saying campaign finance violations, but, you know, do you remove a president for that? I don't know if you do.
This is not directly connected to Trump, but this Maria Butina plea last week, it seems to me, really has implications for the NRA, which is a powerful organization that plays a political role. And this one seems really problematic for the NRA. Ken, do you agree, or do you see this otherwise?
Well, to be honest with you, I always say that every time there's a mass killing with guns, and rifles and assault weapons, that should be a terrible death knell for the NRA, and it never seems to be. But I agree with you. This is the woman from Russia who tried to influence, get involved in the NRA and get her work connections between Russia and the Republican Party. I don't think that's something that the Republican Party is proud of, nor would the NRA be proud of. But the combination of this guilty plea by this Russian by this Russian national, and the fact that Nancy Pelosi said there will be gun legislation coming up from the new Congress when the Democrats take over the House next January. The NRA is not what it used to be, but I still think that you still cross it at your own political peril. We'll see if its influence has waned, but this is certainly a black eye, or at least a big embarrassment for the National Rifle Association.
Yeah, I think some of their financial clout is starting to slip away. And financial clout is what they've lived on for all these decades.
Okay, we have to take a break.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Ken.
I was just going to say, and not only financial clout, but fear of crossing them.
Oh, yeah.
Because,
oh, absolutely.
As you say, it's not only monetary, but they could also back an opponent and things like that. So,
sure.
So both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party were always in awe of the NRA's political strength.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. The United States finds itself in conflict with China, Canada, and the European Union over trade, and at the climate conference in Poland, it conflict with almost every country in the world. What are the implications for our role internationally and for our domestic economy? To explore those issues, we are joined today by political junkie Ken Rudin and WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson. To join the discussion, you can call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. And right as we get started here, I want to make sure we have Peter get an opportunity to ask his question. It sort of grew out of the discussion we were having before the break. Peter, what is your question?
Dan, you're doing a wonderful job. But on top of that, Messrs. Shabbat and Wenstrup and Portman have been breathtakingly silent about things, and there hasn't been much legislation that has been going to formal and public votes. That will change after the first of the year, and I simply hope that we can find out how our three elected congressional people are voting on issues relating with everything, immigration, guns, walls, climate control, Russia, Korea, Saudi Arabia.
Well,
I just want to know how they vote.
Howard?
No, I think that's a very good point, although there's more than three of them in terms of our listening area. There's quite a few. I mean, we go into Indiana, we go into Kentucky. Ohio, of course, has two senators. And we should do that more often. We could probably, do well to at least occasionally record votes on our website, which is a good place to do it.
Ken, I think one of the factors here is that realistically, in these first 2 years, there haven't been that many.
No.
There's not that much legislation that's gone through. A lot of what has happened is because of the president and making decisions and executive orders.
Well, there's a lot of that. I mean, that's definitely true. But at the same time, there's also fights within the Republican Party about where Speaker Ryan wants to take them. I mean, Speaker Ryan seems to be more generous with the kind of legislation he'd like to see passed, but there's strong opposition from his more conservative members. Now, I think that will change, as we've learned from Nancy Pelosi, that there will be a lot of issues that will come to a vote, like climate, as Peter says, like climate change, like guns, like immigration. The question is whether it goes any further than the House, because the Senate will have even a bigger Republican majority than it did this session. It'll have a 53-47. So basically, it'll be tough passing anything out of what comes out of the House into the Senate. But at least there'll be more, hopefully, more negotiations, more perhaps parties talking across party lines, lawmakers talking across party lines, than what we seem to get now. Because right now, it seemed to be mostly about ideology. They're very happy with the judges, thank you very much, but nothing else seemed to get done, certainly about the questions that seem to be affecting so many people, so many Americans, like the immigration, gun, and environmental issues.
Well, one of the issues that Democrats ran very strong on in the fall and tried to make a centerpiece was the whole question of health care. And then last Friday night, the federal judge in Texas ruled the ACA, or sometimes called Obamacare, was unconstitutional. And there's a lot of legal arguments we could get into here about whether this will survive as it gets appealed up through the appeals in the Supreme Court. But what are the political, what's the political fallout from this decision, Ken?
The political ones are not good for the Republican Party, because even though from the beginning the Republican Party was the party that said, let's repeal the Affordable Care Act, let's get rid of Obamacare, and the Democrats said, no, we have to keep it. As we got closer to the election last year, we saw more and more Republicans saying, oh, no, I want to protect your pre-existing conditions part of the health law. They really backtracked on the health law, fearful of what a voter rebellion would look like should the Republicans pay the price for getting rid of pre-existing conditions. But now this judge in Texas, again, I don't think it's going to last. It'll probably be overturned. But this judge in Texas basically said, let's get rid of Obamacare completely. And he gave his reasons for doing that. And it puts Republicans in a very awkward position, because there are at least 20 million Americans who rely on the Affordable Care Act for their health coverage. There are so many people who rely on the promise of pre-existing conditions for coverage. And so if the Republicans are going to be seen as the party that ended all that, that could be a dangerous, dangerous and very difficult political position to be in. Perhaps it's good for them that this is happening like in December, right after the election, than rather than right before election. But it's not good news for the Republican Party, especially aside from the ideological folks who say that this is what government should not be involved in. I think the American people didn't like Obamacare until they realized it was not a better alternative. And now getting rid of it, I think, is a big political price that the Republicans would pay if that judge's ruling stands.
Howard, before you comment, I want to go back Peter's point. What about our local delegation and how do you think this plays with them?
Well, I think they have some of the same problems that Ken was talking about. You know, suddenly they find out that their constituents like a lot of these pieces of the ACA, of Obamacare, not just pre-existing conditions, but, you know, being able to keep a child on until the age of 26, that there are things in Obamacare which people can accept and can support. You know, there are a lot of other things that they don't like. But, you know, if these members of Congress locally, Republicans, have staked out a position and they're just totally against everything in the ACA, then I think they have some explaining to do.
And this is the risk of the very conservative judges that the Senate is confirming and the president is nominating. Because it's one thing for a federal judge to say, let's get rid of Obamacare, this is perfect with my conservative philosophy. He or she doesn't have to run for office every 2 years as members of the House do. So it's one thing for a judge to say, I'm a conservative, let's get rid of the Affordable Care Act. It's other for Republican members of the Congress to say, wait a second, I have to face the voters again in 2020. Right. Do I want to do that? And so that's the risk.
And this judge in Texas, who is a woman, appointed by Bush, Bush 43, left room in here before this would take effect, because she knows, you know, that it's going to be appealed, and then she knows that it's going to be a fight, and she's willing to just let them fight it out.
So it probably headed to the Supreme Court.
Yeah. Eventually, right.
The president has said, in the wake of this, well, now it's time for the Democrats to sit down.
Can I just say something?
Sure.
I don't want to, but the judge in Texas is actually not a woman. Reed O'Connor it was appointed by Bush, but Reed O'Connor is a man. I don't want just calls to come in saying, wait a second, but he is okay. Of the male species.
Okay.
Okay. All right.
Sorry.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay.
Sorry.
All right. Now, anyway, is there the president has said, in light of this, it's time for Republicans and Democrats to sit down and negotiate this, and for the Democrats to cooperate in creating something different than the ACA. What's the likelihood of that happening, Ken?
Well, it's possible. I mean, there were Democrats from the beginning who said, I don't want to throw the baby with the bathwater. I want to. I think there were changes that needed. There are things that could be made, and perhaps the Democrats and Republicans will be amenable to sit down with each other. I mean, that's basically what Trump did with NAFTA. I mean, he got rid of NAFTA because he didn't think it was fair for the United States, and as it turned out, Mexico, Canada, and the U.S. did work out a new alternative, a new replacement for NAFTA. So maybe the president feels that throwing out Obamacare and drawing something up new is workable. I don't think that's possible. I don't think the Democrats would certainly go along with it. But as far as working out kinks in the law, look, I think both sides agree that it's not a perfect law. It can be fixed. And, you know, I mean, I don't know what's possible anymore, but certainly that should be among those that's possible.
Would they do this, you think, while this thing is moving its way through the appeals courts?
Well, that's a very good question. And, you know, it's going to, I assume it's going to wind up in the Supreme Court. But but why not do it now? And what, you know, that's a really good question. I don't know if they're going to wait for the Supreme Court to rule and then suddenly say, okay, let's start all over again. I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's move on to some economic news and some economic situations. One is that the announcement that China is going to suspend increased tariffs on U.S. cars and car parts for 90 days, this negotiating period. Is that a sign of some goodwill here that maybe China and the United States may want to try to work some things out? Ken or Howard?
I think it's probably a good sign any time the Chinese, you know, are willing to give an inch. And, you know, now it's up to, you know, the balls in Trump's court on this. And we'll see how far he's willing to go.
Yep. Ken, any?
Well, I just really don't know because, you know, at one time, every – on one day, the language is belligerent and threatening and, well, we're going to double your tariffs if you do this. And there's another when it seems like the president went out of his way to go easy on that Chinese national who was arrested in Canada for violating the sanctions against Iran. And he said maybe he won't push for extradition if we can have a better trade talk. So it depends on what mood both Xi and Trump are in, but it sounds like it's. I can't imagine a trade war getting to the extremes that it has. But as long as Trump feels that America is winning this war and China is suffering, I don't know how much negotiation will be done because he likes to win, and he may be winning even if the American taxpayer may not be winning.
Well, you know, the reason that the Canadians arrested the Chinese official was at the U.S. request, right?
And, right, exactly.
And,
right.
And, you know, us wanting to now use it as a bargaining chip rather than as a legal issue about what her company did in terms of Iran, you know, that only seems to me to feed right into the narrative the Chinese are trying to develop, which is she's a hostage, economic hostage.
Yeah, I mean, I think the United States had a case, but when Trump said, "Well, I'll be willing to bargain if we can get a better trade deal," that only puts the policy against companies working with Iran. It just makes a farce of the whole policy. So I just like with that Green Beret soldier that Trump seems to say the wrong things at the wrong time and upend any kind of negotiations or letting the law play out for itself. But that's what he does. That's what he has always done, and that's what he continues to do. You know, we only have a few minutes left, but since it's the last show of the year, can I just talk a little bit about some of the giants we've lost? We mentioned George H.W. Bush, but we also lost Barbara Bush this year. We lost, and you know, I don't want to compare him to Trump, but of course we know about Willie Horton and all the things that Bush may have gone overboard on. But there was a decency and a civility in him that I think we appreciate more and more each day. And he was not everybody's favorite president. And as I said, he may have run on, you know, done racial stuff and may have run against patriotism stuff with the ACLU and things like that. But I thought that Bush, he just came from an era where decency and courtesy seemed to, people cared about those things more than they do now. So I think as history goes on, we'll mourn him even more. And then I think of people like John McCain as well, who also believed in that. He could be, you know, an SOB, but at the same time, he really did reach across party lines, and he'll be missed as well.
Yes, and somebody like John McCain, whose word was his bond. It really was. I mean, you could disagree with him, but, you know, if he said it, that's what he meant, and that's what he stuck to.
Was the death of George H.W. Bush really what people were realizing with that? That was an end of an era. It wasn't just, you know, a lot of what got cast and what it was language about President Bush, but you couldn't help but read it as critique of President Trump. But I think there was something deeper to that in the sense that a whole style of politics really ended some time ago, and that was sort of part of it.
Yes, and not only that, I mean, yes, I mean, the conservatives were not happy that he so-called sold out on taxes. You know, he went from read my lips, no new taxes, to a tax rate increase in 1990, and conservatives never forgave him for that. But when you think of what happened, basically Newt Gingrich came to power during the Bush administration because Newt and other conservatives felt that Bush was too accommodating, wanted, you know, and Newt really wanted more conservative results. And so when you think of what Congress has been like in the years after Bush, I mean, under Clinton, under Bush 43, under Obama, both Democrats and Republicans, but I think especially Republicans, seem to be more itching for a fight and more combative rather than working together for the betterment of the country. And so I think not only did we lose something with Bush's passing, but we lost a certain civility in Congress as well that, I mean, look, you know, Congress has always had its battles and always had its crazy figures and always had its you know, they hit each other with canes in the 19th century, but I think we just lost something with Bush's passing that we're just not going to get back anytime soon.
But they quoted the ancients as they were using the canes. But
that's true.
That's right.
Howard?
Exactly.
Were you about to say something there?
No, I absolutely agree with Ken. I mean, it was just hard to watch that funeral and listen to the homily and listen to the words of George W. Bush about his father and not think that, you know, this is the end of something. This is the end of something good. But maybe, just maybe, it can come back someday.
Well, on that sort of positive note, I want to thank Ken and Howard for being here today. Want to wish everyone a great holiday. And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are available on the website, wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.